Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. A couple of weeks ago, this program rebroadcast about 25 minutes of Scott Noble's two-hour documentary, Lifting the Veil. Interesting title. I think of a statue of that name in Tuskegee, Alabama. It's of a kneeling, shackled slave with Booker T. Washington standing, lifting an opaque hood from the man's head. This statue was wonderfully described by the 20th century African-American novelist Ralph Ellison in his wonderful novel, Invisible Man. Ellison's narrator said that, looking at the statue, he couldn't tell which direction the veil was moving. Away from the slave's head, or towards it. Anyway, if you're looking for summer reading, you couldn't do better than Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. It's a funny, ironic coming-of-age story of a young, not-too-aware black A student in America in the 1930s, who accidentally falls in with a communist underground while searching for, and never finding, his identity. In the 1980s, I taught this book to sophomores at the University of Iowa. These white farmers' kids loved the book, and I love it, and you may well too. Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. Your public library has it, and your local bookstore probably does too. Well, why shouldn't every radio program begin with a book review? Scott Noble is a filmmaker with a radical business plan. Give your films away on the internet. You can't buy a Scott Noble film if you try. How does he stay in business? Viam, I guess. Okay, old joke. His film Human Resources was good, and we heard 45 minutes or so of it on this radio program. I think his more recent film, Lifting the Veil, is even better, and let's hear some more of it. The veil is the tissue of lies spun by our one-party government and corporate and media propagandists about what's happening in our country today. So, we're all being invited to get mad at school teachers and firemen for their excessive wages and benefits. And we're to see the necessity of tax cuts for the richest people and increased subsidies for the richest corporations, because these supposedly create new jobs, which, incidentally, America has had too few of for the past 30 years. And we're to support ruinously expensive payments to the military-industrial complex so that they can fight wars to conquer third-world oil-producing countries all over the globe. Wars that the American people strongly oppose, by the way. And to pay for the tax cuts for the billionaires and for all the wars, we'll just reduce your Social Security and Medicare and unemployment benefits. And then blame everything on immigrants from Mexico that were bankrupted by NAFTA. Makes perfect sense to me. How about to you? Well, that's sort of what Lifting the Veil is all about. Today's segment starts with a few words about bipartisanship. Bipartisanship means that the Republicans are devoted to supporting finance capital, big oil, and the war machine, and the Democrats are devoted to supporting finance capital, big oil, and the war machine. So, who's supporting 98% of the voters? The poor, the working class, and now even the middle class? Silly question. Here are more voices from Lifting the Veil.
We have a two-party system. The Democratic Party, which is a party of no ideas, and the Republican Party, which is a party of bad ideas. And the way it works is the Republican stands up in Congress and goes, I got a really bad idea. And the Democrat says, and I can make it.
Senator Bernie Sanders.
This bill does not deal with the absurdity of having the fox guarding the henhouse. I have a hard time understanding why we are giving $700 billion to the Secretary of the Treasury, who was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who, along with other financial institutions, actually got us into this problem.
If there is so much money available, how come it's not being spent to create jobs for millions of jobless people? And why do we continue hearing that the country is in a recovery?
Political cartoonist Ted Rall.
Yeah, it's really crazy. You know, I mean, if you took the $1.4 trillion that were initially spent just to bail out the banks, and you had redistributed that money among all the millions of Americans who were having problems paying their mortgages and who had just lost their jobs in the previous year or two, I remember doing the math in back of the envelope, determining that each one would receive a check for $350,000. The reason is because the U.S. government does not serve the people, and it's not afraid of the people, and even though it knows that its actions are short-sighted and will ultimately lead to its demise, they cannot help themselves. They cannot stop themselves.
To manage wealth requires keen insight, the heart and focus of the hunter, and the understanding that wealth is not about money, but the possibilities it creates. Just as volatility may produce turbulence, there may also be dazzling moments when lightning strikes. Introducing Goldman Sachs Wealth Management.
Noam Chomsky.
Who got us into the financial crisis? People like, for example, Robert Rubin, the Secretary of Treasury under Clinton. His great achievement, one of his great achievements, was to destroy the New Deal legislation. It's called the Glass-Steagall Act, which protected commercial banks from risky lending. So it ensured that commercial banks would have enough liquidity, you know, and they would be regulated, and therefore you'd be pretty safe when you put your money in a bank. Investment firms, on the other hand, take out risky loans, try to make very high profit. If they get into trouble, they expect the government to come in and bail them out, and so on. The Glass-Steagall Act separated those. Rubin led the way to revoking the Glass-Steagall Act. As soon as he did so, he left the government, became a director of Citigroup, a major financial institution, and used the new powers to enable Citigroup to control insurance companies and investment firms and so on, and made plenty of profit from that for a few years until, of course, the whole system collapsed. And Citigroup is now getting tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money to keep them alive. Okay, that's Robert Rubin. He was succeeded as Treasury Secretary by Lawrence Summers.
And as one of the great economic minds of our time, Larry has earned a global reputation for being able to cut to the heart of the most complex and novel policy challenges. With respect to both our current financial crisis and other pressing economic issues of our time, his thinking, writing, and speaking have set the terms of the debate.
Summers, one of his main achievements was to block legislation that would regulate exotic financial instruments, and credit swaps, and so on. The religion under which they operate is what's called the efficient market hypothesis. Everything will take care of itself if you just leave markets alone. They're just magic. No empirical basis, no theoretical basis, but it's a good tool for wealth of the nation. They can make a lot of money out of it. So Summers blocked that legislation. And another factor in the current disastrous financial crisis is the fact that these exotic instruments exploded out of control, and nobody knows who owns what assets are worth. So again, the government has to step in and bail out the wealthy. Government, of course, means the taxpayer.
Where did Geithner work?
Geithner has been a failure at pretty much everything he's done in life.
most of the institutions that destroyed the economy were under his direct regulatory authority.
How did he get the job as Treasury Secretary?
By completely screwing up his job as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
Of course it makes perfect sense. This is not new to Washington. People who will give you the wrong answer, but the answer you want, are invaluable, and they often get promoted precisely because they're willing to say and do absurd things.
Tim Geithner offers not just extensive experience shaping economic policy and managing financial markets. He also has an unparalleled understanding of our current economic crisis in all of its depth, complexity, and urgency. Tim will waste no time getting up to speed. He will start his first day on the job with a unique insight into the failures of today's markets and a clear vision of the steps we must take to revive them.
First of all, let's look at the people who deregulated the industry. They're the same people that are in Obama's White House. Larry Summers is chief economic advisor. Gary Gensler, the head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. I mean, it's the same people that deregulated that are now being asked to re-regulate. I mean, only somebody that's completely out of their minds would believe this.
President Obama today nominated Ben Bernanke for a second four-year term as Federal Reserve Chairman. The president called his actions on the global financial crisis bold and out of the box.
As an expert on the causes of the Great Depression, I'm sure Ben never imagined that he would be part of a team responsible for preventing another.
Wall Street's wealthy and powerful are back to indulging. Pampering at the La Prairie Spa at the Ritz-Carlton involves wearing decadent hors d'oeuvres, cream costing more than $700 for less than 4 ounces, while the caviar facial costs more than $300.
Ruins turning hundreds of homes into shattered garbage. Just 2 hours away from Manhattan, a city plagued with decay. This is Camden, the most broke town in the U.S., with up to 35% of families living in poverty.
A $175 hamburger served up at the Wall Street Burger Shop. 10 ounces of Kobe beef, seared foie gras, aged Gruyere cheese, and...
This is kind of where all the value lies. This is a white truffle as well as a black truffle.
As well as gold, as in gold leaf flakes, to garnish off the burger.
It doesn't taste like anything. It's really just to make it pretty.
There's families that's out here on the streets, a mom and her kids sleeping on a Lower Wacker Drive, cold as it's been, sleeping on a Lower Wacker Drive. When mom goes to sleep, the little kids are up watching over her, and that's sad.
Busyness boosted perhaps by bonuses coming from one street, Wall Street, the symbol of the finance industry, the financial collapse, and record-breaking compensation. $144 billion, apparently, up 4% from last year's record haul.
Goldman Sachs has set aside $6.8 billion for bonuses.
Case in point, General Electric, the corporate giant, received nearly $25 million in stimulus grants. In return, 18,000 U.S.-based employees were laid off. No such promises here on Main Street, where 15 million Americans are officially unemployed, and U.S. poverty levels have reached a 50-year high.
He knows what he wants, don't you, Rocco?
Sure. What's that?
Tell him, Rocco.
Well, I want,
he wants more, don't you, Rocco?
Yeah, that's it. More. That's right, I want more. Will you ever get enough?
Will you, Rocco?
Well, I never have. No, I guess I won't. You, do you know what you want?
Yes, and I had hopes once, but I gave them up.
Hopes for what?
A world in which there's no place for Johnny Rocco.
President, Senator from Vermont is recognized.
Senator Bernie Sanders.
Mr. President, there is a war going on in this country, and I'm not referring to the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. I'm talking about a war being waged by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in this country, against the working families of the United States of America, against the disappearing and shrinking middle class of our country. The reality is that many of the nation's billionaires are on the warpath. They want more, more, more. Their greed has no end, and apparently there is very little concern for our country or for the people of this country if it gets in the way of the accumulation of more and more wealth and more power. Between 1980 and 2005, 80% of all new income created in this country went to the top 1%. 80% of all new income. And that's why people are wondering and asking, what's going on in my life? How come I'm working longer hours for lower wages? How come I'm worrying about whether my kids will have as good a standard of living as I've had?
Economist Richard Wolff.
So we keep producing more and more for the employer. Productivity rises. But the employer doesn't give us any more at all. You do not need an advanced degree in economics. And being a professor of economics, I wouldn't advise it anyway. But you don't need it to understand that if workers are producing more and more for the employer, but he's not giving them more and more, then the whole benefit of rising productivity accrues to profits. So the people who made out like bandits in the last 30 years were the employers, number one, and whoever could get a piece of the profits the employers were getting. We call those people stock owners, shareholders. People who have a piece of a company can get a piece of the profits the company earns. That's how our system works. They did wonderfully. The quintessential story comes to this apex. I've been telling you how Americans went on a borrowing binge. Have any of you wondered, where did the money come to lend all those Americans all that money? Who's the lender? What's the source of the money? And if you understand what I'm about to tell you, you'll understand in a nutshell the remarkable quality of our society over the last 30 years. Because the origin of the money lent to the American worker were the extraordinary profits of American business. They had made so much money because the productivity went up when the wages went down that they turned around and used the extra profits that they got by not paying higher wages to lend it to the workers instead. Think of yourself now, and some of you will enjoy this, as if you were a businessman or a businesswoman, an employer. This is as close to nirvana as business gets. Instead of paying your workers higher wages over time as they work harder and better for you, you don't. Instead of that, we give them a loan, which they have to give back to us with interest. If I had a portable record machine now, I'd play the national anthem.
The United States now has by far the most unequal distribution of income and wealth of any major country on earth. When we were in school, we used to read the textbooks which talked about the banana republics in Latin America.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way, and when they're flecked with brown and have a golden hue, bananas taste the best and are the best for you.
We used to read the books about countries in which a handful of people owned and controlled most of the wealth of those countries. Well, guess what? That's exactly what is happening in the United States today. So I am sure that in a little while, my friends are going to come down to the floor and say, we're very concerned about the deficit. We're very concerned about the national debt. But you know what we're more concerned about? Giving huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. But, Mr. President, the tax issue is just one part of what some of our wealthy friends want to see happen in this country. The reality is that many of these folks want to bring the United States back to where we were in the 1920s. And they want to do their best to eliminate all traces of social legislation which working families fought tooth and nail to develop to bring a modicum of stability and security to their lives. There are people out there, not all, but there are some who want to privatize or completely eliminate Social Security. They want to privatize or cut back substantially on Medicare. Yeah, if you're 75 years of age and you have no money, good luck to you getting your health insurance at an affordable cost from a private insurance company. I am just sure there are all kinds of private insurance companies out there just delighted to take care of low-income seniors who are struggling with cancer or another disease. Mr. President, furthermore, there are corporate leaders out there and many members of Congress who not only want to continue, they want to expand our disastrous trade policies. My wife and I went shopping the other day, started our Christmas shopping. And we looked and we looked, and virtually every product that was out there in the store, consumer products, was China, China, and China. We seem to be a country in which we have a 51st state named China, which is producing virtually all of the products that we as Americans consume. Our trade policy has resulted in the loss of millions of good-paying jobs as large corporations and CEOs have said, why do I want to reinvest in America when I can go to countries where people are paid 50 cents, 75 cents an hour? That's what I'm going to do. To heck with the working people of this country.
Richard Wolff.
Workers in other parts of the world were cheaper. Modern telecommunications made it possible to coordinate with your managers all over the world as quickly as it used to be to walk down the hall and talk to your manager at the end of the corridor. And so America moved production out of the United States, massively. A little statistic again, because economists are expected to throw statistics. I don't want to do too much, but a little, just so you remember that I am an economist. 60% of the goods coming into the United States from China are produced by subsidiaries of American corporations. There's a great temptation in this country to talk about the Chinese. Yes, it's Chinese workers who make them. But 60% of what comes in here is produced by American subsidiaries, American companies that are employing Chinese workers in China, because they're a hell of a lot cheaper than American workers here.
So not only are we saddled with this disastrous trade policy, there are people who actually want to expand it. Now, one of the things that we're going to see going on is that while we struggle with a record-breaking deficit and a large national debt caused by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, caused by tax breaks for the wealthy, caused by an unpaid-for Medicare Part D prescription drug program, caused by the Wall Street bailout, driving up the deficit, driving up the national debt, some people can say, oh my goodness, we got all of those expenses, and then we got to give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, but we want to balance the budget. Gee, how are we going to do that? Well, obviously, we know how they're going to do that. We're going to cut back on health care. We're going to cut back on education. We're going to cut back on child care. We're going to cut back on Pell programs. We just don't have enough money for working families and their needs. We're going to cut back on food stamps. We're surely not going to expand unemployment compensation. We got a higher priority, Mr. President. We have got to give tax breaks to billionaires. I mean, that's what this whole place is about, isn't it? They fund the campaigns. They get what's due them.
Finally, journalist Chris Hedges, interviewed by Amy Goodman.
Well, President Obama signed the controversial $858 billion tax cut legislation into law Friday. At least a quarter of the tax savings under the deal will go to the wealthiest 1% of the population. The only group that'll see its taxes increase are the nation's lowest paid workers. At the same time that this tax bill was passed, which will increase taxes on the working poor and decrease, of course, at the highest level, the wealthiest Americans, link the war with spending on the war with what we're spending on people at home and dealing with poverty here.
Well, you know, this was became a very prominent theme that Martin Luther King beat home, especially in the last years of his life during the Vietnam War, that especially because we're going into debt. I mean, we're building a kind of debt peonage system, which is used then as an excuse to go after wage earners, to go after systems like Social Security. I mean, one of the most pernicious things that Obama did in this tax bill was reduce contributions to Social Security, because, of course, that's next on the target, as well as raise the deficit by $900 billion. What's terrifying about movements like the Tea Party is that they provide a kind of emotional consistency, and of course that undercurrent of racism towards undocumented workers, towards Muslims, is very much a part of the language of that pernicious right wing. But it embraces all things military, as if somehow the military is not part of government. It's an irrational political policy. They want to get government off their backs, but everybody wants to extend unemployment benefits, Social Security, Medicare, and of course not touch the force that is draining, hollowing the country out from the inside, which is the military-industrial complex, 50% of all discretionary spending. And so as these deficits, we've now racked up the largest deficits in human history, and as these deficits are ratcheted upwards, and there is an inability to question the self-destructive quality of the armament industry, then it's taken out on the backs of the working class. Our working class is already in tremendous financial straits, and the middle class.
The incoming House Banking Committee Chair, Spencer Baucus, said in Washington, the view is that the banks are to be regulated. My view is that Washington and the regulators are there to serve the banks.
Well, that's pretty much been the policy since Bill Clinton.
Your assessment of President Obama?
A disaster. A poster child for the bankruptcy of the liberal class. Somebody who, like Clinton, is a self-identified liberal, who speaks in the traditional language of liberalism, but has made war against the core values of liberalism, which is a concern for those people outside the narrow power elite.
We've heard more voices from Scott Noble's film, Lifting the Veil. www.metanoia-films.org. It's free, and you'll find a link to it on our own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and y'all come back next week here. Ciao!